A question this morning: does the Electoral College protect smaller states from bigger ones, or is it an arcane system that needs to go? We'll take your calls in just a moment. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9, and make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and the WJCT app. Just ahead on the show, a look at the history of the Electoral College and the debate over how it elects a president. Give us a call, 549-2937. Then later, marking Epilepsy Awareness Month, plus a musical tribute to the late Leonard Cohen. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, in the past 200 years, there have been more than 700 constitutional amendments introduced to change the Electoral College. None have ever come close to being ratified. But the debate over the Electoral College, which of course picks presidents, has been rekindled this week because Hillary Clinton, in the election last week, won the popular vote over Donald Trump, the president-elect. Of course, Trump won the Electoral College count, which is the vote that matters. Clinton is on track to win the popular vote by as much as 2 million ballots, according to some estimates, as votes on the West Coast continue to be counted. So, this morning, we're going to begin the show with a closer look at the history and purpose of the Electoral College and sharply divided opinions over its usefulness as we take your calls. Two experts in studio, Dr. Yannick Michkowski, UNF Visiting Professor of History. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to be with you. And Dr. Steve Baker, Professor of Political Science at Jacksonville University, also in studio. Good to see you.
Good morning.
And here's our question to callers. Do you support or oppose the Electoral College? Donald Trump won the electoral vote, of course, on election night, while Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. It's the second time in 16 years this has happened in this country. Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet the show. You can weigh in on our Facebook page, too. Dr. Michkowski, let's begin with you and talk for a minute about the history of the Electoral College, first devised at the Constitutional Convention in 1787, and it was initially set up as a compromise.
Yeah, well, as controversial as the Electoral College is today, the historians do debate what exactly the Founding Fathers were thinking, and there are a few things that we can ascribe the Electoral College to. One is, you have to put yourself in the shoes of the Founding Fathers at the time, after the American Revolution and the abuses of Parliament and King George III, the framers of the Constitution were very afraid of strong centralized power. So the Electoral College was one way to protect themselves against, to assert some states' rights. States would be guaranteed some vote in the Electoral College. There was also a concern that the electorate was not well informed. Transportation and communication was not very good back then. So this was a way to ensure that you would have a group of electors, a well-informed group who wouldn't be swayed by passions of the moment, who would decide on who would become president.
That's right. And Dr. Baker, at the time, the country had 13 states. There was concern that one state with a bigger population could override the wishes of a smaller state. The small southern states with slaves who were part of the population but couldn't vote, they were worried that northern states would have more political power. All of that went into the Electoral College. Today, the arguments for junking the Electoral College are that we can now run national elections. Voters have all the information they need. There is no longer slavery. But the con is that smaller states, rural areas fear that their votes would be ignored, that their votes would be swamped by more densely populated states with big cities. So we saw that so strikingly in this election, as voters in cities and coastal areas voted overwhelmingly for Hillary Clinton. Voters in more sparsely populated, more rural states voted for Donald Trump. And their votes, given that the way the Electoral College is weighted, their votes made the difference.
Right. There does seem to be this big sort that people get into their silos and they see the world in a very distinct way, unlike other people do. But even returning back to the historical origins of the Electoral College, we sometimes forget that it wasn't until the 1820s that large numbers of adult males even could vote. At the time Washington was president, only a small fraction of the people were voting. You had to be a property holder. And of course, you That was not unthinkable that women would be voting at that time. Mm-hmm. And so it isn't too surprising that this fear of the tyranny of the majority did tend to prevail at that time. And we still see that reaction today, because a lot of times Americans aren't terribly well informed. And should we simply open it up to a big Democratic vote?
Of course, that's the move behind the debate to get rid of the Electoral College, Dr. Michkowski. One person, one vote. The National Popular Vote Compact is this movement now in about 11 states. It would require its electors, the people that make up the Electoral College, to just vote for whoever got the most votes popularly. On the other side is this argument that, look, this is something that's been enshrined in the Constitution. We shouldn't tinker with it, even if it's not perfect.
Yeah.
Arguments on both sides.
Yeah. Well, it would change the face of campaigning pretty dramatically. And it people from smaller states and from the midsection, the plain states of this country, do feel like they would be overshadowed. The Electoral College has survived through a great number of changes in our campaigning. We went from a tradition of the mute candidate, the candidates who didn't campaign at all, to a sort of hybrid, the front porch campaign in the late 1800s, to the kind of campaigns that we're used to now, with primaries, campaigners crisscrossing the country on the hustings, giving speeches, kissing babies, and all the rest. And the Electoral College has survived through all that, and advocates say that it'll continue to survive as campaigning changes.
Now, as we look at the history of this, Dr. Baker, in the five times the Electoral College elected presidents with fewer popular votes, it's always been a Democrat who lost. Andrew Jackson in 1824, Samuel Tilden in 1876, Grover Cleveland in 1888, Al Gore in 2000, Hillary Clinton in 2016. So, of course, it's not surprising that it's more Democrats than Republicans who see this system now as unfair. That said, it's been pointed out to me that Donald Trump, the president-elect, tweeted this morning, "The Electoral College is actually genius in that it brings all states, including the smaller ones, into play." In 2012, when it appeared as though Barack Obama, for a little bit on election night, was going to win the electoral vote but lose the popular vote to Mitt Romney, Trump tweeted, "Our country is now in serious trouble. The phony Electoral College has made a laughingstock out of our nation." So the Electoral College is seen as the bane of, you know, whomever it's not benefiting, I guess.
Right. Consistency has never been a hallmark of President-elect Trump's interpretations of things. But I do find it interesting that it usually focuses on the advantage of the particular groups. You pointed out that in each case, that there's been a division between the popular vote and the electoral vote. It's been the Democrat that has been disadvantaged. Although in 1824, it's not exactly right, because it was a mm-hmm. contest between two factions of the Democratic Party. But in the end, it did end up that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're going to find that Democrats in particular are going to be much more responsive to the idea that we just ought to have a national election.
And is that politically realistic? Because whether you like the Electoral College or not, it forces the candidates to go to just a few swing states over and over again. Other states never see a president, a presidential candidate visit.
Yeah, as long and as arduous as the campaign season is now, visiting perhaps all 50 states would make it even more protracted and more grueling for candidates. Richard Nixon tried that in 1960. He pledged to visit all 50 states, and he did, but it really took a toll on him. In fact, at one point he was hospitalized, and that was one reason why he looked so badly in that first debate against Kennedy in 1960.
Here's another argument that those opposed to the Electoral College are making. Even though we are a republic, not a direct democracy, they're saying it's not democratic. It violates the principle of one person, one vote. Some states' residents' votes are more equal than others. Here's the example that they gave. In 2012, 37 million people lived in California. 13 million voted for president, giving the 55 electoral votes in California to Barack Obama. Wyoming had fewer than 570,000 residents. 249,000 voters in Wyoming allocated 3 electoral votes to Mitt Romney. So what that means as a practical matter is that in Wyoming, each vote was worth 2.87 votes in California.
Right, that's exactly true. And you're never going to find a fair way to do this. You know, in public policy, we always talk about policy matters. But each time a public policy emerges, there are some groups that are advantaged by it and some groups that are disadvantaged by that. And getting to that proper balance has always been the struggle in the U.S.
In such a big, diverse country, is it even possible to come up with a system that everyone could agree is fair? Is that unrealistic to even think about? Dr. Michkowski.
I think it would be very difficult. And the whole process of changing the Constitution is something that happens only rarely. It's difficult to get consensus to change that document. And I think in general, Americans are proud that their Constitution is the longest lasting written Constitution in the world today.
All right. And lots of calls right now. As we talk about the debate over the Electoral College, it's flared up again. Given that Donald Trump, of course, won the majority of electoral votes on election night, but Hillary Clinton is winning the popular vote. Some estimates show that she might have won the popular vote by as much as 2 million ballots. So the votes are still being counted, however, so we don't have an exact figure to give you this morning. But let's go to your calls all over the listening area. Paul is in Orange Park. Hi, Paul. Good morning.
Good morning. Excellent topic, obviously. Appropriate for this time. When the Electoral College was originally instituted, the vast majority of American citizens did not have much education, and so it was deemed that the choosing of winners of elections should be left to people who are educated. And as you already mentioned, there have been five times in our history when the person who got the most votes did not get elected. What's sad is that too many Americans don't think their vote's going to matter because they know that there's more members of one party than the party that they belong to. And it just seems, and because of that, the percentage of eligible voters is way down. And so the Electoral College doesn't really represent the whole country, all the voters.
All right.
All the people who are eligible to vote.
Thanks, Paul. Yeah.
And I think,
go ahead. Quickly, yeah, go ahead.
I think we need, go back to one person, one vote, and the majority wins.
All right.
And then you'll see the increase. You see a huge increase in participation.
Thank you for that. We're getting emails and tweets saying, and Facebook comments saying the same on our Facebook page. The purpose of the Electoral College was to give the Southern slaveholders disproportionate representation when they had all these souls whom they refused to acknowledge as human beings. If we got rid of the Electoral College, there'd be an end of arguments over who got elected. A majority is a majority. Here's an email from Hank. It seems the Democrats' voter turnout was down and Republican turnout was up, but Democrats still won the popular vote. If that is so, is there any way for Republicans to win at the presidential level without the Electoral College? Of course, there's no way of knowing if some Republicans voted for Hillary Clinton and vice versa, though. So I don't know if it's accurate to say that Democrats won the popular vote. The Democratic candidate did. But Dr. Michkowski, what about those perspectives? And also, we'll take more calls from folks who I'm sure will have a different view. What do you think?
Well, it is more difficult now for the Republican Party to win the popular vote because of the changing demographics of the country, the increasing number of Hispanic votes, which largely migrate toward the Democratic Party, does make it more difficult to the GOP. I want to go back to one thing that we've talked a little bit about this whole concept of democracy. And the Founding Fathers originally were very averse to this notion of the country being a true democracy. They thought of the country as a republic. You don't see the word democracy in the Constitution, and it was sort of a dirty name or a dirty label, a term of disparagement back then. In the Executive Mansion, once Martha Washington saw a smudge on the wall in Philadelphia, and she said, "Oh, some filthy Democrat must have done that." And that's how people thought of Democrats.
And some do today. Let's go to Tim in Fort Caroline. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Hi, I'd like to just say that I support the Electoral College because I don't think that the city centers in New York, Florida, and California should control who's elected. It would take away any say from the middle of the country.
Yeah, thanks for that call, Tim. Okay, and that's certainly a very strong sentiment among Donald Trump voters. They feel that they've been dictated to by voters in the coastal states, and they feel that this is the only bulwark against their vote.
Right, and they can make that argument very logically. You know, and I just did want to return very quickly to the idea of democracy as the idea has evolved over time. The Constitution, when it doesn't even mention the word electoral college, it just says the states will determine how electors will be named. Mm-hmm. And so they really expected, and the number of electors would be based on their representation in Congress. They really expected people to get together and talk among themselves, that there would be a compromise built in. And so they never really thought of it as something reflected directly by democracy.
And that's not how it is today, though. Electors vote the party line today. They cast their ballots for their state's tally, their state's victor.
Right. And it is a representation of the fact that the country is a republic. We elect representatives to mm-hmm. do our governing for us. I also wanted to mention that I'm from New York originally, and mm-hmm. New York in some ways is a microcosm of what's going on. We had two candidates who are both New Yorkers, Hillary Clinton, not a native New Yorker, but at least nominally a New Yorker. And New York City, of course, went heavily toward Hillary Clinton. But if you look at the counties in central New York and upstate New York and also western New York, they went for Donald Trump overwhelmingly. So you'd see splashed out on a larger map that same kind of struggle between rural areas versus urban areas in terms of the popular vote.
Leo is in Arlington this morning. Hi, Leo. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. Excellent subject, and thank you for covering the history of the Electoral College. And, you know, people often say we're a democracy, the world's greatest democracy. I always argue with them that we're not, based on how we achieve the vote. But I had a question. You know, the discussion comes about rural representation being underrepresented. And I wanted your guests to comment. In England, you know, they had the Brexit, and supposedly it was the rural vote that pushed them out of the EU. And that's a direct democracy, I believe. So how does that work? And sometimes a rural vote does carry through.
Yeah. Thanks for that, Leo. You know, before the election, Donald Trump said this is going to be Brexit times 10. Well, he turned out to be right. Voters on this side of the Atlantic that oppose the forces of globalization, want more trade protectionism and so forth, they voted for Trump. The same phenomenon that we saw in England, although as Leo pointed out, in England it is one person, one vote.
Right. That's true. But that does demonstrate this appeal that Trump had that was undetected by some of the polls, and it was largely based on those groups that normally don't participate at mm-hmm. such high levels, especially in rural areas.
Mm-hmm. Lots of calls as we go to Katie on Beach Boulevard. Hi, Katie. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning, Melissa. Good morning, professors.
Good morning.
I actually just have a question concerning kind of like pork and barrel politics with the electoral vote. I just wanted to hear what the professors have to say on that. How do representatives use their, you know, electoral vote as a bargaining chip in addressing other policy issues? And they say, hey, I'll take my electoral vote here and then in exchange for something later on down the line.
Alrighty. What do you think about what do you think, guys?
Well,
I had a little trouble hearing the last part of her call, but go ahead.
With people exchanging their votes, in other words, if you were in New York,
using them as bargaining chips.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That would be part of the tradition of American democracy. You know, sometimes they tried to manipulate the elections, like in 1960, with the Alabama delegation, people like Wallace thought they could be the kingmaker. They anticipated a close election. And by having unpledged electors, they thought that they could, once the election was over, they could divvy them up. And in the 1876 election, in which, you know, Tilden won very conclusively in terms of popular vote over Hayes, a lot of vote trading went on there too. And so at that time, the Electoral College votes were manipulable.
549-2937. Lots of calls. Lively discussion this morning about the Electoral College. Peter in East Arlington. Hi, Peter. Thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning. Yes, I just want to say that I think that the Electoral College circumvents our democracy, and it you know, in the eyes of the rest of the world that do have true democracies and use the popular vote, you know, makes us look maybe childish in their eyes, or it just, you know, circumvents our democracy. Also, it's my understanding that the Electoral College and representatives, they can actually change their vote. They may be subject to a fine, but if they decide that, hey, you know, Donald Trump's not a good choice, perhaps they can change their mind still until they meet in December. So,
thank you for that, Peter. There's a petition up at, I think, at change.org begging the electors to do that. Not a realistic assumption by any means, though. Dr. Michkowski.
Yeah, those are the so-called faithless electors, and it doesn't happen very often. It does happen occasionally. In 1972, for example, there was at least one faithless elector. So there is this concern that this does not reflect the Electoral College does not reflect the true democratic conditions. You could also see it as sort of part of the Founding Fathers' original way of having checks and balances in the government. We have checks and balances among the three branches. We have elements of democracy and monarchy and aristocracy embedded in our government. We have a check and balance within the legislative branch of a bicameral legislature. And this, the Electoral College, in some ways was a check between state government and federal government power.
One more call. Bill in Clay County. Bill, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Melissa. You know, you always hear the phrase, well, we're not a democracy, we're a republic. A republic is a structure. That's how we're structured as a society. It's states with a central government. Democracy is a principle. Laws and structures change, but principles never change. So we operate under the principle of democracy in a republic. A lot of times people will say, well, we don't have to accept the democratic idea because we're not a democracy, but we are. We operate under those principles.
All right. Thanks for that. And Dr. Baker, given that the nation is so closely divided and that we've seen this twice now in the last two decades, who's to say it won't happen again where we see another split like this?
It could well happen again. A lot of people anticipated that in 2012, including, as you mentioned, Donald Trump. So it's entirely possible that it could happen again. In fact, I think it's very likely that it would at some point.
Well, thank you both for being with us. We were joined by Dr. Steve Baker of JU and Dr. Yannick Michkowski of UNF. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you.
Much more still ahead. Back in a moment.
Hendrix Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the president has a lot of authority over the government, but he also faces constraints from the courts, Congress, and existing laws. What a President Trump can and cannot do on his signature campaign promises, including trade, climate, and immigration.
At 10 o'clock on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Hi, I'm Lydia Bastianich.
WJCT and FSCJ Artist Series present an intimate conversation with Lydia Bastianich, host of PBS's Lydia's Kitchen. The event is Saturday, December 3rd at 8 p.m. at the Times Union Center. Join us for an evening of conversation and storytelling, celebrating our love of Italian food. VIP tickets available. Ticket info at fscjartistseries.org.
So join me. Life is a combination of magic and pasta. Noi che felicia.
Franz Schubert turned 21 years old as he was writing his Symphony No. 6. I'm Fred Child. Join me for a concert from Walt Disney Hall in Los Angeles. Gustavo Dudamel conducting the LA Philharmonic in the Symphony No. 6 by the young Franz Schubert. On the next Performance Today from APM. Weeknights at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, hundreds of families depend on the Journey Church in Yulee and their new outreach center. It serves people who need food and spiritual sustenance, too. Now, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, 12.6% of Nassau County's some 76,000 residents live below the poverty level. That's nearly 10,000 people in Nassau. Here with more about the Outreach Center, we're pleased to welcome Senator Aaron Bean, Republican of North Florida. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa Ross. Great to be with you.
Great to be with you. And Lance Jones, pastor at Journey Church in Yulee. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And let's begin with you, Pastor. This new outreach center has already made a huge impact with its food distribution facility. It also serves residents in South Georgia, correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it's a privilege for us to really have identified the needs there in the county and the surrounding area, and we're currently serving over 500 families every single week there at the facility.
And Senator Bean, the need for this, as we know, according to statistics about poverty and food insecurity, the need really can't be overstated.
Well, it is. People want food. That's part of life. What I'm excited about, I spent the day just recently at the Journey Church, the Food Ministry Outreach Center. What's amazing is they're doing it without government. They've gone to grocery stores and other stores to get stuff they'd otherwise dispose of early and said, give it to us and we will give it to people who can put that food to use.
Right. And you're getting food from a whole range of organizations, even grocery stores, feeding Northeast Florida Food Bank. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about how it works.
Well, we've got a whole distribution team that goes around that are able to pick up those items that otherwise would be disposed of in the trash. And so they're within the expiration dates. We come in, we've got walk-in freezers and coolers. We stock it as people come in. They have an opportunity to come through and genuinely have a shopping experience. They get to select their food items, and we go all the way to the process of packing it up for them and delivering it to their vehicle. And as you mentioned, it's not just a nutritional aspect and filling up on food, but also having that interaction with our volunteers, having the opportunity to pray with them and really lift them up beyond the current situation that they're in.
Senator Beam, what do you think this outreach effort has done for Nassau County?
Well, I'll tell you, for the folks that are otherwise wouldn't have food, it's life-sustaining. And it's also enriching. Melissa Ross, one day you come out and be a shopper. That's what I was. I was a shopper with folks, and you walk them through the pantry and help them make their selections and box it up and put it in their car. But it people are truly grateful. But I think the volunteers also benefit from it's a rewarding experience to help others.
Right. You need volunteers to maybe come stack shelves and other things,
yes,
too.
Yes, and we work with a number of organizations there in Nassau County, and that invitation is out as well. If there's other groups that want to come out and serve, that is a wide open invitation for them to participate.
And it seems like this is set up a little differently than some food banks. They're just warehouses, and then they send the food out to other organizations. But people can come to your center and have a shopping experience.
Absolutely. And they come in, and when they check in, we've got our experience from Sunday. We'll play the message up on the screens in our auditorium. They receive a pager, and as that pager goes off, they start that entire experience.
Melissa Ross, it's a science feeding 500 families and getting them through a line.
It's
also a very personal experience. They're not herded like cattle. There, it's individually, people are touched one by one, but it's a feel-good experience. Put that on Melissa's Ross to-do list.
I will. I want to visit. Because isn't it, did you consult with grocery store folks for how to do this? Because there is a logistical way to do this that helps.
And a lot of organizations that want to help don't have the infrastructure. And so we were really in a position to secure some refrigerated vehicles to go there on a regular basis and pick up those items, bring them back, store them, and then be able to be in a position to deliver those.
And you mentioned that this is an entirely private effort, Senator Aaron Bean. How is the Journey Church Outreach Center funded? In terms of overhead, staff?
Well, it's funded by private individuals, by the church offerings, by these stores that have generously given literally, I think, millions of dollars over the course of a year of goods that otherwise wouldn't be. But we also, Melissa Ross, that's a great segue, because December 9th, the Journey Outreach Center is having a golf tournament at none other than the Omni Amelia Island Plantation Course, one of the most beautiful courses in Northeast Florida. Holes on the ocean, holes on the marsh. It's going to be a great time. December 9th.
That's it. Yes. And what a lot of people don't realize is it's not just a singular day on the golf course. What we generate in terms of team sponsorships and individual corporate donations supports our initiatives for the entire year.
So this is a way to support the Outreach Center's food bank. People need to mark their calendars. How can they get their tickets?
Absolutely. You can go online to AuthenticImpact.com. We have all the details there, and you can register online.
It's the new Outreach Center at the Journey Church in Nassau County. Senator Aaron Bean, Republican of North Florida, Pastor Lance Jones of the Journey Church. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being here.
Melissa Ross, always a pleasure to be with you.
Thanks so much. Well, November is National Epilepsy Awareness Month. It's a disease that affects some 3 million Americans, 65 million people around the world. A lifelong First Coast resident, Jeff Clouk of Perfect Golf Event, who has a storied history of golf in this area, is dealing with epilepsy. Now, Clouk is the son of longtime TPC Sawgrass Superintendent Fred Clouk. As an All-American golfer at Florida Southern and a promising PGA Tour player with two wins on the Web.com Tour. But his career was derailed over the last several years by complications from epilepsy. Jeff underwent brain surgery at Emory University Hospital in Atlanta to deal with the effect of seizures that he's been experiencing for a decade now. Jeff Clouk is a member as well of Athletes Versus Epilepsy. And he joins us now to tell us a little bit more about Epilepsy Awareness Month and how he's thriving today in a new career. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good to see you. And first of all, I'm so pleased to share your story because, as I mentioned, this affects some 3 million Americans. It's not a condition that's really that well understood. Tell us a little bit about how you first became affected with epilepsy.
Yes, it was actually in 2006 in Knoxville, Tennessee, and I was finally playing well in a golf tournament, and I made the cut, and it was that night that I had my first seizure, and of course, I had to withdraw from the tournament, and that
came
was
out of nowhere.
Yeah, it came out of nowhere. That was the first time, and I had to withdraw, and it was time to move on.
What was that experience like for you? Did you even know what was happening at first?
No, that was when I was sleeping. So, yeah, you didn't know what was going on. So I had my wife there and then actually our one-year-old son. So that was difficult for everybody to handle.
How long did it take you to get diagnosed and begin the process
right,
of treating it?
Right. It was, I had another tonic-clonic seizure. It would have been about a month and a half later when we had a tournament in Scranton, and I was staying with a friend of mine. So then we realized after that it was time to go home and definitely go see a neurologist and get some advice on what to do.
You went up to Atlanta to Emory, had brain surgery.
I did after several years, and actually saw the doctor last week, and we just trying to figure out exactly where the seizures were coming from. And it's always a very difficult spot to do. I was in the hospital for 3 weeks, and so we were trying to figure out where it came from so you could potentially go in there again and resect the area that was causing the problem.
Were they able to figure
no,
it out?
Not yet. No, not yet. So that was 4 years ago in 2012, so who knows? Maybe technology's gotten a lot better, and we'll see what happens.
So, sadly, you had to transition from your golf-playing career to a new career, Perfect Golf Event. We'll talk more about that in a moment. But your story, I think, will resonate with so many people because epilepsy hasn't slowed you down. But there are complications from epilepsy that can make certain jobs or activities more difficult.
Yeah, for sure. Obviously, my golf got harder with the more medicine I took. And, I mean, I had several other surgeries as well through the years. And, there's side effects to all the medicines, and you got to get used to things. And, but you just handle it the best you can and be as positive as you can. And it's great now to be part of Perfect Golf Event and to I'm going to hopefully try to get having a epilepsy golf tournament next year mm-hmm. and help her raise awareness because we need the more funds being made so we can donate to our different charities.
That's right. A Perfect Golf event is based in Ponte Vedra. It's a new digital mm-hmm. platform, and it's designed around charitable and sponsored golf tournament organizers for thousands of fundraisers.
Right.
It's a way to raise money for a disease or another cause.
Right.
How does it work?
Sure. Well, many of the golf events that we've played in, the fundraising events, have gotten to be so...
cliche.
Yeah, cliche, I guess, yeah. over there. But
we want
to make them more exciting and be 5 hours, you know, five and a half hours, as I've played in a lot of them through the years. And we do it, you can do it in a lot of different ways. And the way I'm going to hopefully be able to do mine is make it where nine holes is traditional golf and nine holes will be par threes with a lot of different prizes and different hole in ones, you know, closest to the pin, different areas like that, and make it more exciting for everybody to play.
Sure.
Because it's all about your guest having fun and also the amount of money you're going to raise. So everybody's probably already played the golf course in general, so you want to go out there and for them to have a great time.
Now, you're also a part of starting the Palencia and Friends Classic. That benefits the First Tee of North Florida. That's coming up January 16th at Palencia Golf Club in St. Augustine.
Mm-hmm.
You're working on other events. It's perfectgolfevent.com for more about Perfect
right.
Golf Event. What would you, for people that don't understand epilepsy well, what would you say to them? What do you think is the biggest misconception that you would like to address?
Well, there's 3 million people in this world, you know, U.S. that have it, and 1 to 26 of us, you know, have had seizures. And just that we don't live in a life any different than anybody else. And I've, you know, not worried about it. And some people are embarrassed about it, but it's just one of the things. We all have something generally wrong with us. So it's just part of life, and you just have to learn with it.
Well, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. Anytime.
He's Perfect Golf Events, Jeff Clouk. November is National Epilepsy Awareness Month. And again, that website, perfectgolfevent.com. Back in a moment.
On the next Fresh Air, what it would take for Donald Trump to fulfill the promises he made during his campaign on issues like climate change, immigration, trade, taxes, abortion rights, foreign policy, and more. And what can he change through executive action? We talk with Evan Osnos, a staff writer for The New Yorker, who writes about this in the current edition. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Unlock your newest member benefit. Over 1,000 episodes of your favorite PBS shows. American Masters. Antiques Roadshow. Nature. Nova. Masterpiece. Watch the best of PBS anytime, anywhere. Become a member. Sign in and start streaming today.
WJCT.org/passport. WJCT and Vistar Credit Union are honoring the memory of Fred Rogers with Mr. Rogers Sweater Drive. The drive runs through November 30th and accepts new and gently used sweaters, jackets, and blankets. Contributions may be dropped at WJCT and all Vistar Credit Union locations and two men in a truck at 8849 Arlington Expressway. For more information, log on to WJCT.org. Contributions will be donated to selected nonprofit facilities within the First Coast area.
Welcome back to the show. Well, here are three words you'll never hear at Christopher Phillips' dinner table. Just grow up. That's because Phillips, author and creator of the wildly popular Socrates Cafe, believes we'd all be better off if adults, actually, us grown-ups, worked a little harder to keep the best qualities of children. Curiosity, forgiveness, empathy, flexibility, hope. Phillips details that conviction in his new book, The Philosophy of Childing, Unlocking Curiosity, Creativity, and Reason Through the Wisdom of Our Youngest. Christopher Phillips, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. It's great to be back.
Great to be having you back on the show. Now, you, of course, have had a lot of success with the format called Socrates Cafe. Mm-hmm. You created that some 20 years ago.
Yes.
And that has spread to a lot of different cities. We'll explain about that in a moment. But this new book, The Philosophy of Childing, is so fascinating. You're saying all of us as adults should really try to be more like our kids.
Yes. I'm also saying we should join forces more with our kids, that we're in equal human beings, but we are different, but in ways that should be admired. And I think that if we involve kids more in inquiry, that we would grow more as adults, no matter whether we are childless or whatever, that having children in our orbit and actually inquiring with them and thinking that we can learn something through their lenses is valuable.
For those of us who are parents, we definitely try to, most of us, I think, try yes. to gain that kind of interaction with our children. Mm-hmm. A lot of parents, though, have been raised with this idea, even today, that children should be seen and not heard.
Mm-hmm.
We know better than our kids, you know.
Yes. I think that sometimes we just have to parent. But as somebody who became a parent late in life, I have a 3-year-old and a 10-year-old, so I need to live a very long time. I have
keep taking those vitamins.
I try to be far more open and attuned to what they're asking and to having an inquiry with them. So you'll see on my childing.org page, I'll have all these videos of dialogues with my daughters. Even a 3-year-old can ask questions that if you really take the time to absorb it, can be stunning for you.
Kids' moral clarity and honesty, too, has an effect on adults, of keeping adults honest, forcing adults to watch their behavior. It's really remarkable. And when you see a child enter a room full of adults, everyone's behavior changes right away.
It does. And I think of the dialogue I'll hold tonight on what should we be teaching our children, I'll quickly spin it to what can our children teach us, because they do have singular stores of wisdom. This word childing actually came from a 13th century. It was in our lexicon in the 13th century. And it's about blossoming from a healthy core. Mm-hmm. And how do we make sure that we don't unlearn those values that are hardwired into us of empathy and a unique form of reasoning that we have really from the get-go?
Now, your new book, The Philosophy of Childing, stems from another project in some respects, the Socrates Cafe.
Yes.
You started that 20 years ago, and it's grown to meetups all over the country.
There's hundreds of these, and even in countries like Syria and Egypt, they're now flourishing, which is not my big grandiose plan was to have just one group. So we do have these gatherings where people, you know, escape from the hurly-burly of everyday life and engage in timely and timeless philosophical questions. And those childlike but by no means childish questioning lenses get turned back on.
And I look forward to another meeting of the Socrates Cafe in our area, hopefully soon. But in the meantime, you have a book signing and a talk tonight in Gainesville.
Yes, I'll be at the College of Santa Fe in Gainesville. I've been doing activities here at the Florida State College of Jacksonville for many, many years. And they have two campuses where they have a long time ongoing Socrates Cafes. But yes, I'll be at the College of Santa Fe in Gainesville tonight.
People need to come out and meet you, learn about this book, The Philosophy of Childing, author Christopher Phillips. The book is out now, and Phillips is also a recent senior writing and research fellow with Penn's Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing. He's also a network fellow at Harvard's Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics. Again, that book is called The Philosophy of Childing. Christopher Phillips, such a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
Well, finally this hour, a special treat tonight on 89.9 FM, an evening of Leonard Cohen, starting at 9 o'clock. On the beloved program, The Electro Lounge, with an hour of uninterrupted music by the late Cohen, spanning his amazing career. Electro Lounge host David Luckin is here with a little preview and a CD giveaway. Good morning.
Oh, good morning, Melissa. And we're so happy to devote the evening to Leonard Cohen. As you said, the first hour uninterrupted. The second hour is going to be really interesting because it's composed of an interview he did around the release of his album called Old Ideas in 2012, recorded at Joe's Pub in New York City. So you're going to hear Leonard Cohen in his own words. Plus, you're going to hear new bands like Old 97s, Cold War Kids, New Pornographers, and more current artists talk about how Cohen's music influenced their lives and their careers. So an evening of Leonard Cohen at 89.9. We will miss him. He was so brilliant, and some of us have listened to him for four decades.
Isn't that amazing? He passed away this week. Of course, he was famous for a song called Hallelujah.
And Suzanne.
But he had quite a catalog. Let's talk a little bit about the CD that you brought with you today.
A nice 39-track Bowie legacy, and it includes the Pat Metheny, This Is Not America, plus his duet with Mick Jagger, Dancing in the Streets, plus all the things you would expect from Mr. Bowie's career.
Okay, yeah, so to be clear, we're not giving away Leonard Cohen's CD.
No, I just thought I'd bring this in.
You just thought you'd bring in another CD.
It came in the mail. Sony Legacy is so kind to send us extra copies to give away to our loyal listeners.
So if you'd like a free copy, a free CD, it's David Bowie Legacy. This is a double set.
39 songs.
39
it's a nice
songs.
Set, beautiful set. Still sealed.
Email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. It's David's giveaway for the week. Bowie Legacy, we will pick one winner at random, and we will cut off the emails at 10:30 a.m. So that's happening. But also, as we talk more about Cohen, you're going to be doing an hour-long tribute on The Lounge tonight, and then again at 11 p.m., more Leonard Cohen music. Ryan Banks' Indie Endeavor.
He's going to play some new interpretations in the new bands that pay tribute to Leonard Cohen also. But just a giant in the music industry. I mean, Leon Russell, David Bowie, Leonard Cohen. We've lost too many good people this year.
I was just going to say that. So, some true giants are leaving the stage, leaving this world. It really is the end of a musical era in so many ways for the baby boomer generation.
Oh, totally. And lucky for us, when musicians die, their legacy of recordings lives on. So we get to hear, whether it's Duke Ellington or Fats Waller or Leon Russell, you can listen for generations to this music. Because it's art, and it's collectible, and it's just the best of America or best of the world.
For a lot of younger music fans, when Cohen died, they had to look him up. They didn't necessarily know who he was.
But they probably knew Hallelujah if they'd seen, was it Shrek, right?
Uh-huh.
And Jeff Buckley's version, and if they watched True Detective, Nevermind was the theme song on HBO. So he has never left the scene. We're going to close tonight's first hour with brand new music that I just played 2 weeks ago from So You Want It Darker. And it's some dark music. So I'm happy to give up our time for someone like Leonard Cohen and introduce, as you say, young people to his music who may not know it anything more than Hallelujah or Suzanne or Nevermind from HBO.
So tonight at 9 on 89.9 FM, don't miss David's full hour of Leonard Cohen, a tribute to the late musician's incredible career. That's at 9 on the Electro Lounge. And then at 11 p.m., Ryan Bank, host of Indie Endeavor, will also have a musical tribute to Leonard Cohen. Always good to see you, and thanks so much.
Thanks for making the time.
We're going to close with some of the music of Leonard Cohen, so you can enjoy that as well. That's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board, and the show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Diane Reams up next. The president has a lot of authority over the government, but he also faces constraints from the courts, Congress, and existing laws. What Trump can and can't do on his signature campaign promises. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and this has been First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be back tomorrow at 9 a.m. Enjoy the music.
The way from China, and just when you mean to tell her that you have no love to give her, then she gets you on her wavelength, and she lets the river answer that you've always been her lover. And you want to travel with her, and you want to travel blind, and you know that she will trust you, for you've touched her perfect body with your mind. And Jesus was a sailor when he walked upon the water. and he spent a long time watching from his lonely wooden tower. And when he knew for certain only drowning men could see him, he said, all men will be sailors then until the sea shall free them. But he himself was broken long before the sky would open. Forsaken, almost human, he sank beneath your wisdom like a stone. You want to travel with him, and you want to travel blind, and you think maybe you'll trust him, for he's touched your perfect body with his mind. Now Suzanne takes your hand and she leads you to the river. She is wearing rags and feathers from Salvation Army counters, and the sun pours down like honey on Our Lady of the Harbor. And she shows you where to look among the garbage and the flowers. There are heroes in the seaweed, there are children in the morning, they are leaning for love, and they will lean that way forever while Suzanne holds the mirror. And you want to travel with her, and you want to travel blind, and you can trust her, for she's touched your perfect body with her mind.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.